to get all the stuff out. I'm Bradley B. I'm an addict. I'm a grateful member of Narcotics Anonymous.
Yeah.
Grateful. With the gift of gratitude, that's our theme for this convention tonight. I'm going to talk a lot about my gratitude. Grateful first to God for His grace and His mercy. If you're new to Narcotics Anonymous and you don't know about grace and mercy, I want you to know. Grace is when you get something that you don't have coming. And mercy is when you don't get something that you do have coming. Yeah. So, I got like props because first prop is like I was telling somebody earlier, like I used to get a resentment when the speaker would get up there and they had like a notes like what the fuck is that message coming? Like, isn't the message coming from God, right? It's supposed to like flow through you and all of that stuff, right? So what do you need notes for, right? I just want you to know, I've reached the age now where I need notes. And if you stay clean long enough, you're going to get the opportunity to walk in the shoes for every single judgment you make in your recovery. I'm just saying. The day is coming. So, this rock is petrified dinosaur shit. I'm not kidding. I brought this to the podium so I would always have my shit together. This rock, if you look at it in the light, it has a tree that comes up and branches that branch out. And that represents the spiritual family. When I showed up at the hotel this past Thursday, I went up and got checked in, and then I turned around to go to the elevator, and there were three women sitting in the lobby in the chairs. One was my sponsee, Kristen H., who I've sponsored for 30-some years. One was my sponsee, Catherine K., from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, who came to Baltimore to support me. I don't know how long I've supported you. 13 years. That means we're on the 13th step, right? Just kidding. And then Chris, who is my grand sponsee, who lives in southern Maryland now, but got clean in Seattle area. So they were sitting there to support me. They just came to be here to support me so that I could do God's work and carry the message of recovery that I have for you this weekend. So thank you so much for your love and support. And my dear friend, okay, so that's all that. I've been clean since the 15th day of September 1981 BC. That's before crack. And 15,502 days today. That means no time off for bad behavior, but there's been a lot of that too through the years. And in order to like keep myself on track, I'm going to have to do that. I want to thank the committee or any person who worked on the committee. For all of the work that y'all had to do, I've worked on lots of convention committees, and I know what kind of work it takes all year long to put together a convention like this. And so if we could all please give a really, really heartfelt... Living Clean meeting of Narcotics Anonymous that meets on Thursday nights at 7:30 in Towson, Maryland. Because on Thursday when I came in not knowing a soul in town, we got online and found a meeting and we showed up at the Living Clean meeting at 7:30 on Thursday in Towson. And They loved up on us. Let me tell you, thank you to the Living Queensland. Thank all the speakers who spoke before me, because oh my gosh, you guys were stellar. I want to thank Susie, who shared last night. If you weren't here, you really missed out on some good stuff. I want to thank Heather, who was up and at him early this morning to share an incredible message of recovery. If you missed it, I don't know. I want to thank Mark. You knocked it out of the park this afternoon. You really did. And I appreciated your message a lot. I heard what I needed to hear from the speakers who've come before me, and also all the workshop speakers that I sat in on. I really heard a clear message from the woman speaker this afternoon, from JoJo. Thank you, JoJo, for your beautiful, grace-filled message. And I know this is the part, right? But I'm going to get to the real shit. So there were three guys in the banquet tonight sitting at a back table. And I looked around the banquet room, and these three young guys were sitting in this back table. There was a group of them, but three of them were young, like young enough to be my grandkids. And I don't know how your life is, but I have one of my grandsons. His name is Colton. Colton is 29 years old, and he is a straight-up fentanyl addict, in and out of penitentiaries, in and out of jails, like shooting, overdosing, selling, buying, rolling cars, running from the cops, like you name it, you know, robbing, all the scandalous shit we do, right? Colton's still out there. Colton knows he has a grandmother who's clean and been clean a long time. Colton's never seen me loaded. I've been clean longer than he's been on the face of the earth. But these three young guys at this table in the back of the banquet room were the sign from God that I got today. They were the sign from God that young addicts get clean and stay clean. And that they sit in these rooms and join people who are old enough to be their grandmothers. That have been here, sitting here for a long time. And so those three were Kyle, Jomo, and Jonathan. Thank you for being here to be my sign from God. Certainly not least, I want to thank Mike. Mike was the newcomer at our table at the banquet when the oldest clean time had to give stuff to the newcomer person. And Mike was our newcomer person with 18 months. And so, Mike, I just love you. I hope that I see you the next time I come here. And whenever that is, I hope you have that many years plus 18 months. And that's my thing. Where do I start? I didn't know the last time I got loaded that it was going to be the last time I got loaded. If I had known it was going to be the last time I got loaded, I would have had a much better time. I did not have a good time. I went to a party in the projects of West Seattle and regained consciousness 3 days later in some sticker bushes out by SeaTac Airport. And I don't know what happened. I remember, leaving the party and walking into my last blackout. Don't know if I got in a car with somebody. Don't know if I was trying to walk down the highway and got hit by a car. Don't know if people in the party that I pissed off had come after me, because I did that a lot. I'm a little girl with a big attitude, right? That means you get hurt a lot when you're out there. And I got hurt a lot. I just know that I spent my first 15 days in an ICU in a level 1 trauma center in Seattle, Washington. And I had no idea that those were the first days of my recovery. I don't know if I would have stayed if I had known. But I do have to tell you that the last 5 years I got loaded, I wanted to be clean every day. The last 5 years that I used against my own will. And I know some of y'all know what I'm talking about. I was not having a good time. I was doing things like going, back in those days you could go into the churches at 2 o'clock in the morning. The churches were always unlocked. Now they lock everything up because we're scandalous, right? Yeah. And so, but back in those days you could go into churches at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'd shut the bar down and I'd go sit in the church. Because I intuitively knew that whatever was wrong with me was in my spirit. Because it was my spirit that felt like it had died. That was the part of me that felt that I couldn't find my way to anymore. I felt like I lived in the land of the living dead. And so I would go sit in those churches and I would hope that whatever those people got, those people that came out of there on Sunday morning and they looked bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and they had clean faces and they had the light in their eyes, I hoped that whatever they had, it would rub off on me. Never rubbed off on me. Never did rub off on me. But I tried. And I went to other fellowships. I went to other programs. I went to this one, and I went to that one, and I went to the other one. But nobody where I lived told me about Narcotics Anonymous. Because Narcotics Anonymous, when I got clean, was in its infancy in the Seattle area. There were only 2 meetings a week. And in those days, you had to meet kind of in secret. Because churches and places like that didn't want people like us to hold meetings in their midst. If you're lucky enough to have gotten clean, when I got clean, there was no books. There was no basic text. There was no how and why. There was no living clean. There was nowhere to turn except to your predecessors. And my predecessors didn't play no games. They said, put your ass on the chair from prayer to prayer.
Yeah.
Like, you don't get up and stretch your shit back and forth to the talking machine. Like, you don't do that. You put your ass in the chair from prayer to prayer. And you listen for the message. You don't listen for the differences. You listen for the similarities. What is this person who's talking of, what are they talking about that you can relate to? Find a way to relate. If you're new to Narcotics Anonymous and you're here tonight, if you have 365 days, 364 days or less, will you please stand up? Stand up right now, please. Yes, these are our newcomers. Yes. Day. Thank you guys for being here, and I hope you hear one thing that keeps you coming back. So, I was an adorable newcomer. I just have to tell you. I was freaking adorable. I don't even know where to start. I'm going to tell you very little about my story. I'll tell you this. I started ripping when I was 13 years old, and I got clean when I was 30 years old. By the time I was 30 years old, I'd been married 4 times, and I had 2 teenagers that were already using. They were 13 and 11. Okay? I was unemployed and unemployable, and hadn't held a job in over 20 years. I've been living in Section 8. My hustle was welfare. That was part of my hustle. That was my hustle for shelter and food for my kids, right? So I would hustle the welfare system. I lived on food stamps. I'd hustle food stamps. I lived in Section 8 housing. I lived in the projects, whichever, like whatever was available, because I'd always get thrown out or get my power turned off, or, you know, I'd have to do a hefty garbage bag move in the middle of the night. You know how the shit goes down, right? My first child was born while I was chained and shackled to a delivery table in a women's prison. I went to prison because I could not behave. I went to prison. taxi on the West Coast. I ran stolen cars. I love taking your car. I did. I liked your car much better than I liked mine. And so I would just take your car sometimes and all the shit in it, too. Anyway, so that was how I paid rent and took care of that stuff. Then there was the hustle I had to get the money to get the dope. And my hustle to get the money to get the dope was always sex. Like, that was the commodity. That's what I brought to the table. That's what I thought was the only thing I had to offer. I didn't think I had anything else of any real value. Like, who I was not, had no value. But sex, I could, like, polish the chrome on a Harley Davidson. Get a job. I'd been on welfare 20 years. I was thinking about it by that time. She said to me that, you know, Brenda, we are self-supporting through our own contributions. And you really do need to think about, like, employment. And I said, well, Lou, what do you want me to do? She said, well, Brenda, you got kids. You could work in a daycare. I said, Lou, I fucking hate kids. I don't like kids. Like, no, I'm not doing that. Like, I've got my limits. You know what I mean? And then she said, well, you're always cooking for your family. You like to be single, like to cook. Maybe you could be a cook at a restaurant. And I said, Luke, I hate cooking. How can I be a cook? I don't even like it. Especially don't like cooking for nobody else. I cook because I have to. She said, okay, how about, like, you're always cleaning the house and making the beds and doing all that stuff. Maybe you could work in a motel or be like a maid or something like that. I said, Lou, I hate doing labor. Like, I had no open mind at all, newcomers. So if you're here and your mind ain't very open, or you're, like, just starting to think about employment, like, okay, you got time. So, but I did get the Seattle Times, and I did get the newspaper, and I sat in the floor that morning, and I went through every single one. They had one ads back then. It wasn't all on the internet. This is before internet. This is before cell phones. I'm fucking old. So I got the newspaper out. I'm, like, reading all the want ads in the back of the newspaper, and I see this one that says, sales position available, no experience required. Must be open-minded. I thought, oh my God, this is my job. I'm totally the one for this. I've been selling dope for like 20 years now. I could sell birth control to the Pope if I wanted to. And so I called the guy, and we talked on the phone for a while. He said, you have just the kind of personality we're looking for. I said, oh, great, because I need a job. And he said, okay, how about this? How about if we meet in this little public coffee shop, and I'll bring some of the product, and you can come, and we'll see how you think this is going to work for you. So I said, okay, and we set the appointment. 2 p.m. My sponsor doesn't get off work till 5. So at 2 p.m, I show up in the coffee shop. This guy shows me the product. This is going to work for me. I can do this. I can sell this. So he hired me on the spot and gave me, like, a bag with product in it so that I could start my sales that day. So 5 o'clock, my sponsor gets home. I bring her up. Lou, it's Brenda. Guess what? I got a job. What? Yes, I got a job. She said, that's awesome, Brenda. What are you going to be doing? I said, well, I'm going to be selling vibrators door to door. I said the sponsor thing like only sponsors would say this, right? She said, Brenda, do you think that selling vibrators door to door is going to be conducive to a spiritual way of life? And I, the newcomer, said, oh my God, Lou, I got this one thing in the bag that I am pretty sure came from God himself. In my share, and I think it's because he wants the newcomers to know that it don't matter where you start, it only matters where you're going, right? Like, stuff takes time around here. It don't change overnight. And I want you to know I sold vibrators for 18 months out of the back of my car at every NA meeting in the meeting, and she would do this. With her watch, that means the meeting starts in 5 minutes. You better shut your trunk and get the hell up here, right? And I did not make millions of dollars. I did not get off welfare, but it gave me time to make some application for school, and I was able to go on and get an education, and my life began to change. Education made a big difference in my recovery. I was an eighth grade dropout, really. I never really went to school after I was probably 14 or 15 years old. And so, you know, so I just wanted to talk about that. I want to talk about family. And I felt really compelled about this when I was doing my prayer and meditation. I want to tell you about my family. Some of you might relate to your family. I already told you about Colton. My dad was an addict. Three of my four grandparents were addicts. My mother was a religious fanatic. She never used anything, but she promoted religion perpetually on me. And none of the religious stuff I was learning as a kid that my mother insisted on jived with any of the shit that the addicts were doing and the pedophiles. And the thieves and the liars that were in my family. Like none of it went together. It made no sense. And by the time I was 13 years old, I just said, you know what, fuck this. Fuck this, fuck you, fuck your relatives in California, fuck you, I'm out of here. And I started my journey into addiction. I believe that getting loaded saved my life. I believe that if I had not gotten loaded for those 20 years, that the pain of living the life that I had been living would have led me to suicide. I believe that getting loaded day after day after day, all day, every day, saved my life. Long enough for me to get to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. In the end, the only thing that had ever been a solution to my life, the only thing that felt like it almost worked, the only thing that made me feel like I was almost okay, had become the problem. And now I had no idea what the solution was. Both of those teenagers that were kids when I got here are grown up now. My daughter's 55, she'll be 56 in July. My son is, he'll be 54 next month, the 29th of March. My daughter's been clean 30 years. My son Todd has been clean 21 years. They both go to meetings. And they stay clean other ways too. My son plays clean and sober baseball, and there's all kinds of ways and activities you can do to stay clean. They each went on to have three children of their own. So I have five grandsons and one granddaughter. My oldest grandson, Tyler, has been clean 8 years. goes to meetings of Narcotics Anonymous. My grandson Vince has been clean for 5 years. My grandson Christian has been clean for 3 years. And when he had a year clean, a mentally ill tenant who lived in an apartment underneath his in the apartment complex set the apartments on fire. And my grandson was severely burned. He spent 30 days in the burn center, in the ICU burn center at Harborview Hospital in Seattle, Washington. And he came, while he was there, I had a career in Seattle, I'll tell you about in a minute, but I worked for a long time out of the emergency room often at Harborview. And so I knew some of the doctors there who were addictionologists. They specialized in us. That was their specialty as doctors. And so I called them and I said, my grandson's in the burn unit. And he had a year clean. And he's terribly burned. They may have to take his feet off. And I need an addictionologist on his team. I need to make sure that there's an addictionologist on his team because this kid was doing really good and I know he wants to stay clean. His wife was also burned and so was her baby on the back of the hand. There were 4 people injured. They were 3 of them. And they made sure that he got an addictionologist. And when he came out, he still faced many, 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 many surgeries that first year. I think he had 17 surgeries the first year after the fire. And so they put him on Suboxone. Oh, my God, she said the word. Yes, I did. They put him on Suboxone. And you know what? They were able to manage the pain and do some of the stuff that they were doing with the Suboxone that he was on. They were also able to manage the addiction until they could get through all of the surgeries and things that he faced, and eventually they were able to titrate his Suboxone dose to the point where he's back, NA clean, going to meetings, and survived all of that. So thank you, God, for that. I'm so grateful for that. I told you about my grandson, Colton. He's the fourth one. I have one grandson that's not an addict. He's doing really well. He's a photographer and a world-class chef in Seattle area. He studies he does a student program under Wolfgang Puck in the Seattle area. He's brilliant. And he's made a nice career for himself. And then I have one granddaughter. My granddaughter is a scandalous addict. She has been. I think her mother turned her out to prostitution and heroin when she was 10. And 4 days after her 18th birthday, she participated in a robbery that turned into a murder one. And she's been in prison the last 10 years of her life. And I believe that prison is saving her life. I believe that prison is saving her life. I believe if she was out on the streets with a fentanyl epidemic going on, that she'd be dead today. And so I'm grateful to God for that. I want to tell you that my brother was in the rooms with us for 10 years. And in about 1998, he got hurt at work. He started using medication, then he started misusing medication, and then he started using. And February 21st, we just had the anniversary, 21 years ago, he died in a single motor vehicle accident. He was driving 75 miles an hour when he slammed his car into a 16-foot concrete wall on his daughter's 17th birthday. It destroyed his life and it destroyed her life. In fact, his whole family blew up. It was him and his wife and 3 kids. All of them were addicts. They were already using before. But once my brother was killed, it blew that family apart. Eventually, I got a call from one of his middle son, and he said, Aunt Brenda, I'm going to die if I stay out here. I really need help. I said, where are you? He said, I'm in Seattle. I said, I'm down in Tacoma, but I'm not coming to get you. If you're really serious about this, get your ass on the bus and get here. Call me when you get to this phone booth at this corner, and I'll come pick you up. And he did. And you know what? He just had 10, 11 years clean. Yeah. 10 years clean. Meetings of Narcotics Anonymous. He's the only member of my brother's family that's still alive. Because on Christmas Eve of 2019, that beautiful 17-year-old girl that was devastated when her father died on her 17th birthday was found dead in the spare room at her mother's house of a fentanyl overdose. And the following March 6th of 2020, my oldest sister Linda's only grandson was found dead of a fentanyl overdose. And this last summer, June 3rd, 2023, they found my niece that died of the fentanyl overdose. They found her older brother dead in the same bed of a fentanyl overdose. That's what the disease of addiction has done to my life. And so you can see, like in my family, it's real clear. You may be an addict, but there is a road to recovery. There's a road to recovery. None of my grandkids have ever seen me loaded. I have 11 great-grands. I got 11 great-grands. Oh, my God. They are so freaking cute. the oldest one is 10. And I look at him sometimes and think, are you the one?
Yeah.
I am. No. And so, you know, what I know is that not only am I powerless over my addiction, and that I could not get myself clean, like I had to have a power greater than me to get clean. Like I can't do this by myself. I haven't stayed clean for 15,502 days on my own. I needed a power greater than me. And a lot of times that power, because there were a lot of times I prayed to a God I didn't believe in. My predecessors told me there were only four things I want to do to stay clean. They said you need to go to meetings when there's a million other places you'd rather be. They said you need to talk about the real shit in meetings when you don't feel like talking to one asshole in the room. They said you need to take a look at yourself when it's everybody else's inventory you're taking. And you need to pray to God even if you don't believe so. And they told me that if I would do those four things, that I would stay clean. And through the years, I've managed to do just that. Although I did take a lot of inventories on the way. Okay, so let's see. I wanted to talk to you. Now, I don't know if I told you this, but I'm kind of a rarity in Narcotics Anonymous because I'm an addict who has never used since my first meeting. I've never used again. I never used again because I finally found that thing that I was looking for. Like that thing that I kept going and sitting in the churches for, that thing that I kept going to other fellowships looking for, I finally found it. The first time I sat in a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous and they read how it works and they read who's an addict and they read why are we here and what is the NA program, like that was me. They were talking about me. I knew that I had found my place when I heard the literature of Narcotics Anonymous. But the thing is, when I was doing my prayer and meditation, I got a clear message to talk to you guys about recovery. I mean, about relapse. About relapse. Now, I don't know who's relapsed. I don't know anybody in the neighborhood. So you might have the ones that are relapsing all the time. I think sometimes those addicts get a bad name. Because it says in the literature that recovery starts when you begin to take the steps. That means if you've never worked the steps and you just keep having lapses in your clean time, you're not a relapser. You're not clean. You're like, you got to get clean and get to some steps before you can relapse, right? And so, at least that was what I thought. But I want to talk to you about how relapse is for me. So, What happens for me is I always get off track behaviorally because I have these things called defects of character. Now, I thought they were exclusive to me. However, I have found out through my 6th and 7th step work that it is a human characteristic. It's not a defects of character aren't characteristics of addicts. They are characteristics of human beings. We're all defective. Like, that's just the deal, right? And so, so I would start misbehaving, but I didn't want my sponsor to know. Now, misbehaving for me might mean that I'm eating 2-pound bags of M&Ms and washing them down with Coke, because I'm a compulsive overeater, and I'm a sugar addict. Now, misbehaving might mean going to the casino with the rent money because I'm a little short. No, I'm going to make it up. That never happens. That never happens. Acting out might mean that I'm staying 4 hours a night overtime at work. Because running, being on every NA service committee in town, where I'm here and I'm there and I'm the chair of that meeting and I'm the secretary over there and I'm the treasurer of that and I'm an area and I'm over here in region, and it's like doing. So I don't ever hear the silence of that still voice within myself. It's that. It's those behaviors. It's when I'm having an affair with other people's husbands in the rooms. Or any kind of sexual misbehavior. You know what your behavior is. I'm not up here telling you. So just misbehaving, right? But what happens for me is I get that dirty little secret going. Now, I don't want to pick up the phone and call my sponsor because I know she's going to call my ass out on it, right? She's going to put me on the carpet right here, right now. And surely my sponsor will count me off to you guys in meetings, too. She don't, there ain't no such thing as anonymity with my sponsor. But that's part of why I picked her, because I needed to be outed. Over and over and over and over again. And when the humiliation got too great, I learned about humility. Okay? So now I got a dirty little secret. And I'm showing up in meetings, but I'm not talking about the dirty little secret. In fact, I'm not talking about much at all. I've sort of started to pull away from y'all in meetings. I'm not telling you anything that's going on in this crazy head of mine. Right? And I start to feel the distance. I start to feel disconnected from you mentally because you don't know the secret shit that's going on in here anymore. Now, that causes me to have feelings. I start to have emotions, feelings. Feelings of shame, feelings of guilt, feelings of remorse, feelings of hopelessness. How do I get out of this? How do I rescue myself from this big mess I've got myself in? But if I tell you guys how I'm feeling, then I have to tell you the crazy shit that I've been doing and the stuff that's going on in this insane head of mine. So I make a decision that I'm going to not talk to you about how I'm feeling. And I start to distance from you emotionally. Now, always after the meetings, we'd go hang out. You know, we'd go to Denny's or we'd go, you know, wherever you go around. We'd hang out after the meeting. We'd have the meeting after the meeting, right? Except now, when you guys slide up next to me in the booth, you're going, Brenda, what's going on with you? You're not talking in the meetings. You're not talking in the meetings about what's going on in your life. You're not talking about what's going on in your head. You're not talking about your feelings. What's going on with you? So I make another decision. The decision I make is to stop going to get together with you guys and socialize after the meeting. And I begin to distance from you socially. So now I'm going to meetings, but I'm not talking. And I'm not feeling, and I'm not going to socialize with you after the meetings. And I show up right before the meeting starts, and the second the circle breaks, I run out the door and get in my car before any of you can connect with me. And one night as I'm doing that, one of y'all knocks on my door, on my window. Brenda, what's up with you? What's going on with you? You're not talking in meetings, you're not sharing your feelings, you're not going to socialize with us anymore. What's going on? I mutter, Nothing's wrong. I'm fine. Everything's good. I got this. And you roll back to the meeting, and I roll out of the parking lot. And in my head, I go, these motherfuckers in Narcotics Anonymous, they're all up in my business. They are all up in my business. Now, these people are playing me way too close. And, this has got to go. So I make a decision that I'm going to stop physically showing up at meetings. So now I'm separated from you mentally, emotionally, socially, and physically. Now I'm holed up in my apartment. I'm holed up in my apartment. I've been here 3 weeks. I'm in a full-blown depression, right? Can't figure out what's wrong with me, right? I'm depressed. I haven't done any self-care. I haven't brushed my teeth so long I got little sweaters growing on them. You know? And the dishes have green hairs in the sink in the kitchen. Like, I'm not doing nothing. I'm not taking care of none of my business. Nothing. And I know I'm in trouble. I know that if I pick up that phone, I'm going to call the connection. Because I'm disconnected from you guys. It says in the literature that isolation always leads to insanity. It doesn't say once in a while or occasionally or on your birthday. It says isolation always leads to insanity. And by that time, I'm full-blown insane. All the symptoms of my mental illness have reappeared. I'm depressed. I'm anxiety-ridden. I'm having panic attacks. I can't breathe. I can't sleep. Are you with me? I haven't used, and I am in a full-blown relapse. I'm either going to pick up the phone and call the connection and get loaded to put myself out of my misery, or I'm going to drop to my knees and get a connection with a power greater than me that I frequently don't understand and get connected with one of you. Get connected with one of you. So for the last 42 plus years, when I got to that place in my relapses, I would pick up the phone and I would call my sponsor. And when I would call my sponsor, she'd answer the phone and I'd just start puking it out, you know. Oh, I got to wake up with the phone. I'm sure I don't have been doing nothing. I'm too bad. And there's a lot of them. And she'd go, I already know all the shit you've been doing. Like everybody, like I'm a big secret, right? And so then she would say, I'd say, okay, well, what are we going to do? She said, I'm going to be there in 15 minutes to pick you up. We're going to meetings. Of course, it's Saturday night. It's the biggest meeting in town, right? Everybody's going to hear my shit. She pulls up in 10 minutes, because anytime I needed my sponsor in 15, she was there in 10. She pulls up in 10 minutes. I jump in the car. She says, I said, okay, what do I do when I get there? Now, mind you, I'm a mess. I got no makeup on. I've been, like, I still got sweaters on my teeth, like nothing. Like, I'm stinking, right? And she said, well, we're going to go to the meeting, and when we get there, I want you to sit your ass on the chair right next to the town gossip. You know who? The one that's going to have your shit on Facebook by the time you get home from the meeting? Yeah. You're going to sit right next to that addict. And as soon as they open the meeting up for sharing, I want to see your hand in the air. And you need to tell on yourself. You need to tell on yourself. And so I'm following directions now. Even though everything inside of me is terrified. I'm terrified. I can hardly breathe. I'm so scared. But as soon as they, like, my hand goes up, there's like three newcomers in the meeting. I'm Brenda. I've been here for 10 years. Bye. And the newcomers are like, holy fuck, what did you get into, right? And as soon as I get done puking it all out, guess what? I feel better. I just cried all the way through. I've been slinging snot. I've been crying, weeping. I'm talking to you while I'm going. And you guys know all the dirty little secrets. There's no more dirt inside of me. I'm clean in here. I'm clean that moment. And so I... think that y'all are going to reject me, but guess what? When the meeting's over and I've connected with you mentally, and I've reconnected with you emotionally, one of y'all slips up next to me and says, hey, we're going for coffee after the meeting. You want to go along? I start crying again, because I don't think I deserve to go. I don't think I'm worth going. But you do. You do. My value to you has been important, more important than what I think of myself for a long time. Because your opinion of me was much better than mine. And so we get together after the meeting and we'd socialize and I'd get connected socially. And then I would get home and I would wash myself and take a shower and brush my teeth, put on fresh pajamas, and I would drop to my knees and say, God, I can't believe you saved my life one more time. Thank you, God, for saving my life one more time. And that, for me, is a relapse. I've had hundreds of those. If you're here tonight and you're in one of those, if you're in one of those, when you get to the place where you either pick up the phone and call the connection here, or you pick up the phone and call the connection here, think about that. Think about that. You cannot save your face and your ass at the same time. Save your ass. I wanted to tell you guys that in this circle, I don't know if you can see, but there's all these things. All these feelings, proud, valuable, strong, humble, flexible, honest, loyal, nurturing, brilliant. And right here it says connected. Yeah. Isn't that ironic that when I was getting loaded, the most important person in my life was the connection? And now that I'm clean, the most important thing in my recovery is the connection. That's why COVID was so hard on us. Like, where the hell is our fellowship? The fellowship that was here before COVID. Some of them have died. I had a friend who went out, 77 years old, 44 years clean, relapsed behind medication while he was living on his own during COVID, ended up living in his car and shooting heroin on the streets of L.A. until he died because it was mixed with shit that wasn't even out there when he was using. Having a lot of clean time is not an antidote to this disease. The antidote to this disease is the connection that I get when I sit physically in a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, when I talk honestly about the crazy, insane shit that goes on inside this head, when I talk from my heart about the pain that I'm in right now because on September 7th last, my mother died. I've had my mother the whole 72 years that I've been on the earth. You didn't think I was that old, did you? Just kidding. But she's been my whole life the whole time, right? She passed last September. I love you, Mom. I know you're here with me now. I know you're in the light. Thank you for I know you're in the arms of God. Thank you for being here. And I just want to close with this, because I know I'm sure I'm out of time. Like, probably like 3 days passed, right? I want you to know that. 1 minute or? If it takes a little more than one, I'll be okay. Okay. I want to tell you, newcomers, listen up. There was this kid that used to live in Towson, Maryland. And every day he would ride his bike down Main Street. And one day he was riding down Main Street, and he came to this, like, pet shop, like a little pet store. And in the window of the pet store, there was a little pile of puppies. And he jumped off his bike and leaned his bike up against the building, and he pressed his nose up against the window because those were the cutest puppies he'd ever seen in his life. He wanted one so bad. So he pushed the door to the shop open. He told the shopkeeper, hey, mister, how much do you want for those little dogs? And the shopkeeper said, I want $2.57. The kid counted all his money. He had $2.60. He said, "Mister, I want to buy a dog." So the shopkeeper took him over, and one at a time he took the little puppies out of the window, and one at a time he would hold them and they would nip at his ear and lick his neck, and he just loved those little dogs. And finally the shopkeeper said, "Okay, young man, which one is it going to be?" And he said, "Well, I really like those five or six that were in the pile right there, but there's one in the back over there, and he's kind of laying by himself, and the other puppies aren't by him, but I really like that little dog." And the shopkeeper said, "Oh, listen, kid, you can't buy that dog. That dog's defective." And the little kid said, "What do you mean?" And the shopkeeper said, "Well, when that little dog was getting born and he was going through his mother's birth canal, he got twisted. His hip got twisted, and he broke his hip. And when it healed, it didn't heal right. So he's never walked right. And sometimes when he tries to run, he just falls down. He wouldn't make a very good playmate for a fine boy like you." The little kid thought about it for a minute, and he said, "No, I really want to buy that dog." And the shopkeeper said, "Well, listen, I'm not going to charge you the same amount for a defective dog that I would charge for the perfectly good one, so why don't you just give me a dollar and we'll call it a day?" The little kid said, "Nope. You told me $2.57, and that's what I'm going to pay." And so the shopkeeper kind of scratched his head, took the little dog out of the pile, made a little cardboard box, stuck the little dog in, and gave him to the kid. The kid paid his money, and gets over to the door, and just as the kid's going out the door, the shopkeeper says, "Hey, kid, tell me, what was it about that dog, and why did you insist on paying $2.57 when I was going to let you have him for a dollar?" The little kid sat down in his box with the puppy, and then he rolled up his pant leg, and on his leg there was an iron brace. He said, "Well, mister, when I was getting born, I was going through my mother's birth canal. Things got a little twisted, and I was born with a deformity. And I've never walked right, and sometimes kids have made fun of me in school, and they've teased me. And sometimes when they ask me to play in baseball, I fall down because I don't have the strength to stay up." He said, "But this little dog in this box, me and him, we got something in common.
Right.
And if I have to stop and wait for him to catch up with me, I will. And I believe that if he has to stop and wait for me to get back up and catch up with him, he'll wait for me." And the moral of that story is about the therapeutic value of one addict helping another. Like, we're all defective. We're all defective, and the defects are common characteristics among us all. I'm Brenda B. I'm a grateful member of my class.